Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys. In the United States, testosterone prescribing has gone up, tripling over the years 2001 to 2011. This despite low testosterone or male hypogonadism, the prevalence is roughly staying the same. Additionally, many have been prescribed testosterone without any prior testing. Many of those treated with testosterone actually have a normal initial testosterone level. Across the globe, this increase in prescription trend persists, going up by over 90% in countries like the UK. While some of this is due to increased testing and addressing previously unmet needs, a good portion of this increase is likely due to testosterone being portrayed as the fountain of youth for men on the internet and social media. In this podcast, we'll discuss the physiology of testosterone, how it changes over time, as well as the diagnosis, workup, and treatment of low testosterone. All that and more on this week's episode of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Pioneer Belts. At Pioneer Belts, they have belts for all applications. If you're interested on how belts work or how to choose a belt, check out our podcast episode number 219. Most people will do best with a 4-inch wide belt that's 10 millimeters thick, either single prong or lever, depending on the fastening mechanism that you prefer. Pioneer has industry-exclusive micro-adjustments on their lever belts for ease of use without tools. They also make custom belts to your specs, depending on what you want. Trusted by some of the world's strongest athletes, choose Pioneer for your weightlifting belts and accessories. Head to generalleathercraft.com and tell them Barbell Medicine sent you. This podcast is also brought to you by Vuori. Vuori makes super high quality, versatile clothing to wear both inside and outside of the gym for men and women. Again, my favorite are the core shorts and the Rise Tee. I've been super impressed with the core shorts and their longevity for now about 4 months that I've been training in them. No pilling, no tears, they're super stretchy, and honestly, they look great both inside and outside the gym. Same thing with the Rise Tee. Every time I wash it, comes out of the laundry, perfect, ready to wear, whether I'm going to the gym or just wearing it casually. So check them out. They also have golf stuff. If you're a golfer and you're wondering, hey, what sort of stuff could I wear on the course that would double, you know, in my day-to-day life? It's really, really good stuff. It looks clean and, you know, look good, feel good, play well. That's my motto. So go to Vuori. All of their sources are sustainable and they offset their carbon footprint 100%. You can go to their website, vuori.com/barbell, and get 20% off your first order. All right, we're here back on the Barbell Medicine Podcast with the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, dude?
Hey, man. Glad to be back.
You know, I think there's some podcasts out there, they have like catchphrases or like drops that they place like periodically throughout the thing, if, especially if it's live. Yours would just be a collection of all of your sighs prior, like while I'm introducing you. It would just be, So glad. Yeah. Well, I'm happy that you're here. We're going to talk about, as indicated in the introduction, testosterone replacement therapy. This is a very dude heavy, dude focused podcast. But, you know, if you're of the fairer sex and you're listening to this and you're like, how does this pertain to me? It's like, look, if you're a coach, trainer, you're a subject matter expert within the physical culture space, if you're a medical professional, this stuff's going to be interesting to you, I think. I hope. Anyway, so stay tuned. Any updates for the crowd about what's going on with you? You guys doing good?
Going to be getting back in the hospital at the end of this week, and training actually seems to be maybe starting to go okay for the first time in a while. So what can I say?
I know when you start posting your training, like things are going good. Like, it's not just a highlight reel, but you're like, no one cares if I'm deadlifting 500 unless it's for 15 or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's
not which worth is not my
true.
Time.
Which is not true. People care. People do care, but I understand where you're at. You're like, oh, I guess I am strong. I guess
It might not be so much whether I think other people care. It's like it reflects how much my caring.
Yeah. That's fair.
Like, I don't care if I deadlift 500 for anything less than whatever, 10 or 15. So once it starts exceeding that, I'm like, okay, maybe I'll start caring again.
Yeah. This block that I'm currently on has a lot of supersets. Okay. And I've been priding myself on my cardiorespiratory fitness as of late. And it's true, like my per week, I'm probably in that 1500-ish met minutes per week. I'm doing like a lot of conditioning.
Yeah.
Again, the goal, like, don't suck on a dirt bike, because to me it's like dangerous. Like, if I get tired on a dirt bike, I'm like, well, the smart part of me was like, slow down, sir. But you know, the aggro part is like, send it, you're good to go. And so I'd rather just not get tired. But in any case, it's a totally different thing with the supersets. Like, that sort of acute muscular failure and then back on another thing, more muscular failure, it's a different thing. And obviously people listening to this are like, yeah, dude, supersets are different. And I'm like, I just have never been this strong while doing supersets, if that makes sense.
Like
early on in training, I'm like, oh, I gotta do a superset. And it's like the weights actually aren't that heavy. And now I'm like, all right, I got an RDL, you know, in the 400s, and then I gotta go do some hamstring curls, and oh boy, like, I've never felt a pump like this. So
yeah,
that's fun.
I've significantly increased my conditioning in the past few months. I have a Concept 2 rower that I acquired earlier this year, and I've been doing that probably about 5 times a week or so for a fair amount of time, just very low intensity though. And it's been going fine.
I will tell you the bro tip here. Concept 2 makes like an iPad mount that goes on the Concept 2 rower.
Yeah, mine came with one.
Oh, okay. So I just have a cell phone. Like, mine came with the cell phone mount, not the iPad mount.
I see.
And so once I upgraded to the iPad mount, my world, I was transported. My world changed. So if you're listening to this and you're like, how do you make it fun? I'm like, I'm watching YouTube videos. I'm watching documentaries. I'm getting smarter while I'm getting fitter.
Yeah.
I did read this thing. I think it was in Steve Magnus's book, like, Do Hard Things. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about how, like, elite level endurance athletes, they don't use music, they don't use distractions from like, this hurts, or I feel that. They want to tune in, they want to focus in on like that pain. And I'm like, I guess I'm not elite, because I don't.
I mean, I just compare it to like, what, when I was swimming, there wasn't really a distraction available. Your face is in the water, you're just trying to like breathe. There's no, you know, that was like the early days of like, you know, really, really crappy quality, like in-ear MP3 players that people would get, which I never got or used. That was like not the thing at the time. And so, yeah, that was most of my training, was just like effectively in silence, face in the water. And, you know, you have no choice but to like be in tune with that kind of thing. But nowadays, with respect to the conditioning I do, yeah, I'm not trying to do that.
You don't want to suffer. I wonder if there's some sort of like waterproof, like, ear, like AirPods.
Now I'm sure this stuff is way better now. I'm just saying, like, back then when I was that was like the first model where it was like you could fit probably, I don't know, maybe 30 songs or something in the battery. I don't know. It's like the very first MP3 player for pools. But yeah, I'm sure things are better now.
I still wish I had one of those iPod, what is it, minis, the touch, the little like tiny little guys that clip on
like a piece of gum almost.
I wish I had one of those. In any case, we have new content on the website. We published an article on belts. Everything you want to know about belts. If you listen to the podcast, you have a good sense of this stuff. But sometimes reading the written word, you know, really drives it home. And there's some additional information there. So check that out. Also, if you're not subscribed to our newsletter yet, you should do so. So every month we just fire out a newsletter filled with original content. This one's going to be on artificial sweeteners. And yes, we did do a podcast on artificial sweeteners, non-sugar sweeteners. But this one has an additional take on this brand new paper that came out showing that a particular metabolite potentially, or contaminant of sucralose, which is Splenda, might be mutagenic. Some people, like some person posted that in our Facebook group, and it's been making the Twitter rounds, like, is this particular
causing DNA damage? I think that's what the claim was, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the, what is it? Sucralose 6-acetate or whatever, which, by the way, is not in Splenda at all. Like, it's not in there. It doesn't get metabolized to that, just whatever. And then there's a host of problems with the study and the claims, like, oh, you should avoid this sort of thing. But you got to sign up for the newsletter to get that information. And then
I wonder what the difference in the effect size would be if it, let's say it does cause some amount of DNA damage. I wonder how that compares with the amount of DNA damage folks get from just like going out in the sun without sunscreen.
Yeah. So they found evidence that there was some like DNA damage at very high levels, which is like above what you would, it would be like 60 something packets a day of Splenda would be what solid. You would need to get to that dose. Yeah. And even that, it was not correlated to any clinical outcome thing. One. And again, it's not in Splenda. It's not in like, anyway. All right. So I'll talk about that more in the newsletter. So just go over to the website. After about 10 seconds, a little pop-up window will pop up and you just put your email in there and I'll send you some information. That would be fun. Also, we have live in-person seminars still coming up at the end of this month. Our pain and rehab team will be in Bozeman, Montana. They're doing it there. I know there's some spots left. I feel like Bozeman in the summer. That's, I don't know. It probably is. It's probably going to be epic. Like every time I go look for stock images of Bozeman, Montana, I'm like, I want to go there.
Yeah.
And then our pain and rehab team will also be in Los Angeles in September. We, for our traditional 2-day health and fitness, health and performance seminar, will be in at Untamed Strength in Sacramento, California in October. And we'll also be down under in Sydney, Australia, for those who didn't catch that accent. We'll be there in January of 2024. I don't know what else is coming for 2024, but that's our seminar schedule. So if you want to join us or our pain and rehab team at a live in-person seminar, check out the link in the description below after you listen to this podcast. We also dropped some new merchandise. We're calling it the Street Tee. I don't know where that name came from, but let me just tell, this is my favorite shirt that we've ever made. It's the oversized fit is not only very flattering, but also very comfortable to train in. So like some people like the tri-blend stuff or whatever. It's like stretchy and form-fitting or whatever. But I will tell you, a knurled barbell on your back through tri-blend stuff is not particularly comfortable. This thing, you could put one of those cheese grater bars on my back, I'd be fine. Totally fine. It's just, it's something about the material. I just, yeah, really, really nice. So check that out on our website. I know we have limited supplies left. When we dropped them, they sold out pretty quickly. So I know there's just still some sizes left. And lastly, we're dropping some new templates this week. The Bodybuilding 2 template will come out. That'll have some interesting stuff like a dual progression. So people are looking at that, and an additional updated ebook with more stuff on how to get bigger muscles. And we're going to have some educational material dropping in the near future as well. So stay tuned to that. If you're signed up for the newsletter, you're going to get updates along with, again, this original content. So, you know, do all that. All right. Enough self-aggrandizement. Let's talk about testosterone replacement therapy. All right. So let's start with the overview here. Like, how do we even make T? And I'll use T and total testosterone back and forth a few times. So don't at me on this. I'm just trying to not say testosterone, you know, 1,000 times in this podcast. We did 2 episodes. I believe it was like 102 and 103 on testosterone. Now that's like 2.5 hours of material. And I think that I would say those podcasts are still valid. I like the material in there or whatever. The thing what we didn't do is we didn't go through like a stepwise, like here is how somebody would be diagnosed, worked up, treated, monitored, etc. for testosterone replacement therapy. We also didn't address the question, are testosterone levels dropping in the population over time? Just that's a very popular to say these days. And so we're going to go a little deeper this time around and hopefully give you guys the information that you've been searching for. So a little overview here. So there is this HPT axis, and that's an acronym that stands for hypothalamus pituitary testes. That's the HPT. All right. So to start, we have gonadotropin releasing hormone, which is GnRH, is produced by the hypothalamus that travels through the blood to the anterior pituitary gland in a pulsatile fashion. So GnRH is released from the hypothalamus, goes to the anterior portion of the pituitary gland in a pulsatile fashion. So higher levels early in the morning, lower levels at night, and makes the anterior pituitary gland release luteinizing hormone, which is LH, and also follicle stimulating hormone, which is FSH. So that comes from the anterior pituitary gland. Again, both of those things go into the bloodstream and then go to their targets, which are the testes. LH acts on the Leydig cells within the testes, and that produces about 95% of the circulating testosterone. So once LH binds to these Leydig cells in the testes, they effectively trigger those cells to produce testosterone. There's about 400 million of these cells in the testes. And yeah, in general, they produce testosterone. That's 95% of the circulating testosterone of men. The other 5% is from the adrenal gland, which is just a piece of fatty tissue sitting on top of the kidneys. FSH, on the other hand, follicle stimulating hormone, that travels to the Sertoli cells, also in the testes, and that's more involved in spermatogenesis, which is a fancy way of saying making sperm. Austin's nodding. That's what you don't see. If you're listening to this,
this would be me like nodding in agreement with one of my residents walking me through the physiologic pathway here. Yes, agree so far.
Thanks. So in any case, testosterone itself, as produced by the Leydig cells of the testes, has a negative feedback at multiple levels. So level number one, in the anterior pituitary gland. So basically it signals to the anterior pituitary gland, yo, we got enough testosterone. We don't need as much LH. Chill down, bro. It also has negative feedback at the level of the hypothalamus, saying, yo, dog, T levels are good. Cut back on the GnRH. So if testosterone levels are low, the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland both get signaled like, not enough T in the system. Let's pump out some more LH, some more GnRH. But if testosterone levels are elevated or normal, both of those glands basically are tempered down or attenuated.
Yeah, that's probably the most important thing to understand about this topic, and also just endocrinology in general, like hormone signaling in general, is this kind of concept of feedback, not only for understanding how the system works, but also more importantly, because it has relevance for how we interpret the blood tests that we get on people. And so, you know, we will interpret a low testosterone measurement differently depending on whether at the same time FSH and LH levels are high or if they are normal or low. Those lead us in two different directions of trying to kind of localize where the problem is, and being able to interpret those tests accurately requires a good understanding of this feedback system. And the reason I'm emphasizing this up front is because, as people might know from prior podcasts, I'm kind of a stickler for testing and accurate diagnosis. And a lot of places that are, you know, not practicing great medicine might test and diagnose people with testosterone problems really without an adequate evaluation of these other aspects of the system to try to identify actually where the problem is and maybe go down a different route than just putting the person on testosterone replacement. So yeah, that's why understanding this feedback is important, and we'll come back and probably reiterate it when it comes to the test interpretation.
Yeah. So you can have problems at any different point along this sort of pathway. So for example, if there's a problem with the testes themselves, meaning that they're getting the signal from the LH and FSH, but not producing testosterone, that's called primary hypogonadism. Or you could have a problem at the level of the hypothalamus and or the pituitary, which basically means you're not getting enough GnRH and or not enough LH and FSH. And that's called secondary or tertiary hypogonadism. And at this point, that's kind of an academic distinction. We'll get into like why that matters later on. But effectively, if you have a problem at any point or multiple points along the way, you can have signs and symptoms of hypogonadism or testosterone deficiency syndrome, depending on which nomenclature you tend to prefer. But yeah, if you have low testosterone because of one of those, it kind of differentiates which path you go down as far as where the problem is. In any case, most testosterone circulates in one of three forms. So form number one is when testosterone is bound to a protein called steroid hormone binding globulin, which you might know as SHBG. There are two hypotheses here that bound, well, hypothesis number one is that bound testosterone, if it's bound to either SHBG or, as we'll see in the next form, albumin, some people think, hey, that testosterone does not work in any tissues because it's bound up. It's bound to this protein, doesn't do anything. That's hypothesis one. Hypothesis two is that, hey, those two bound types of testosterone do work, just a little bit less active and takes longer for them to do things, but still free testosterone, the third form, would be like the most active. So two different hypotheses. We don't have great data on this, but there's kind of like warring factions here within this sort of endocrinology testosterone field. So in any case, form number one is protein bound to steroid hormone binding globulin. Basically, testosterone floating around by itself is kind of fragile, and so it needs to be carried around by a protein. So that's form number one. There is a second form where testosterone is bound to albumin. It's a little bit weaker bond than when it's bonded to steroid hormone binding globulin. So again, this may be active in some tissues, but it takes a little bit of time for it to dissociate from albumin. And then there's free testosterone, finally, the third form. It's about 1% to 4% of all total testosterone. It's supposed to be active on all tissues. Again, that hypothesis that it's the only active form, there's some controversy around that. And this is relatively difficult to measure accurately in labs. And we'll see that there are multiple formulae and different ways to like sort of get a free testosterone number. You might also be familiar with a term called bioavailable testosterone, and that is the combination of testosterone that's bound to albumin plus the calculated free testosterone fraction. So again, there's just a bunch of different formula that you can use to end up getting different sort of values depending on which type of testosterone that you're measuring. But total testosterone, most common measurement of testosterone, you are basically capturing all of these three different forms, the one that's bound to SHBG, the one that's bound to albumin, and free testosterone. Austin, you ever just check your testosterone? Just for fun?
I've had zero testosterone measurements in my life.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So no personal experience measuring. Nope. Got it.
I've measured it in patients, but not of my own. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's move on here to what are normal testosterone levels in men? So the normal range, again, this varies on the laboratory itself, but most different guidelines that are available for talking about normal testosterone levels, male hypogonadism, et cetera, say that the normal range of total testosterone is between 300 to 800 nanograms per deciliter. Sometimes that upper bound moves up to 1,000. Again, it's laboratory dependent. So each lab will have its own sort of normal range, but 300 to 800 is what you're going to see in the literature most often. Sometimes, again, that creeps up to 1,000. There's analytical variance, which occurs due to differences in the testing methods, the equipment, which results or analyte values are used or measured. And in total testosterone, that variance is 4.3%. There's also biological variance in total testosterone levels. And biological variation is that which occurs when the same test is run repeatedly on an individual using the appropriate methodology, and you just get different values. It just varies. And that biological variance for total testosterone levels is 12.4%. So putting this in a practical example, if you measured a total testosterone value for an individual at 500, you could measure it between 350 up to 675 on the second test, and it may not actually be any different because both those differences are explained by the combination of both analytical and biological variations. So there, if somebody goes, it was 500 the first time and I tested the second time, it's 350, it's lower. It's like, it actually might be the same. In fact, is likely to be the same. I can't confidently say one way or the other, and neither can anybody else.
Yeah. And I think this is a super important thing to emphasize, and this applies to a lot of other tests. I think I just answered a question on our forum today about somebody who was concerned that their blood sugar tests had increased from, like, you know, 94 to 102 or something like that. And it's like, I don't really interpret those as being significantly different due to combinations of analytical variation and biological variation. I actually shared a resource on this from the BMJ that maybe would be worth us including a link to that tool in the show notes, because it has a whole bunch of tests and it will actually show you the variation, and you can put in two different numbers of tests and it'll tell you, is this different enough for us to be confident that they are actually different values, or are they kind of within each other's error bar? Because, you know, you gave a relatively large example of a difference, but people interpret smaller differences as being important all the time. They're like, my testosterone was 440 on this one test and now it's like 500 on this test. And I'm like, that doesn't mean anything to me, honestly, because I'm proud of you. I'm happy for you. But, you know, realistically, I cannot be super confident that that represents a real increase or quote unquote improvement, if that's what you're looking for, or whatever the case is. This stuff is all super, super messy. And that's part of why, among many other reasons, we advise against people just getting these things checked, because it's challenging enough to interpret them even when they are being measured, you know, in an appropriate context. If they're being measured for no reason, that makes it even harder to interpret these things or to interpret changes in them over time.
Yep. Yeah. The resource is called Your Results May Vary, The Imprecision of Medical Measurements. And I have linked that in the show notes. So there's a bunch of different tests that they have.
It's like an awesome tool.
Yeah. Cool tool. I love that. Okay. So that's, you know, testosterone and its normal levels and how it's produced. So what is the natural trajectory of total testosterone over time? So in general, in the fourth and fifth decade of life, testosterone levels tend to decline in men. And so a recent study of 1,500 men aged 20 to 44 had their total testosterone levels measured. And sort of the average value, which the way these researchers measured it, they called it a middle tertile range. And so just to explain that, a tertile just means they split up the data into thirds, and sort of the middle range, the middle third, spanned from these values. So for individuals aged 20 to 24, that sort of middle range spanned between 409 to 558 nanograms per deciliter. And then 20 years later, 40 to 44 year olds, it ranged from 350 to 473 nanograms per deciliter. A few things. So one, yes, that does appear to be lower. But again, if we go back to that analytical and biological variance, we would sort of expect some noise in there. So I wouldn't say it's a huge difference, but it does, again, appear to decline, most notably starting in the fourth and fifth decade. As far as why these things are declining, that is a far more interesting question. So for example, the European Male Aging Study, which is the acronym is not great. It's called EMAS. I feel like they could have done better with that, but it is what it is. They found that the overwhelming contribution to the apparent age-related decline in testosterone levels is likely not due to chronological aging per se, but rather in the accumulation of age-associated comorbidities such as obesity, diabetes, etc., resulting in the suppression of luteinizing hormone, or LH, secretion. That's one of those hormones from the anterior pituitary gland, goes to the testes, says, hey, testes, pump out testosterone. And so if you're accumulating diseases like obesity, type 2 diabetes, other inflammatory conditions, and or taking medications that are known to interact with this stuff.
Yeah, or alcohol.
Alcohol, opioids. Oh, yep. Look, we're going to get into all of this.
Sleep apnea. Yes.
Yeah, totally. Your testosterone levels are likely to decline mainly through a suppression of LH secretion. So I don't know that I would expect testosterone to decline with regular healthy aging, if you wanted to like put quotes around healthy. But yeah, if you accumulate diseases and different medical conditions as you age, which is pretty normal in modern day, then yeah, levels can decline. There's two other data sets that basically have converging evidence showing the same exact thing. The survey on prevalence in East China for metabolic diseases and risk factors, called the SPECT study, a much better acronym, showed the exact same relationship. And in an Australian study, a fit, healthy, community-dwelling older men found similar levels, so not statistically different, total testosterone levels in older men compared to younger men. Basically saying if you maintained your health, again, throughout your lifespan, testosterone levels are likely to be the same. And so that's, you know, people say, oh, testosterone levels go down as you age. That seems to be what we see in the real world. But as far as why that's happening, it's not just like, the clocks are ticking on the old testes.
Yeah.
Can't pump out the tea. It's more so like, yeah, there's other stuff going on under the hood. Which leads us to this next question, which I think is, I mean, it's just gotten so pervasive. It's almost assumed to be true. It has become popular to say that testosterone levels are declining in a population over time in an age-independent manner, basically saying something like, hey, an average 22-year-old male today has roughly the same testosterone levels as a 67-year-old man had in year 2000. There's been various permutations of this, or like, oh, testosterone levels are half of what they were in the 70s, or you know, something like that. And people will then start hemming and hawing about all sorts of things like plastics or estrogens in the diet and weird stuff.
It's right? The libs.
Yeah. Like honestly, if you voted for Biden, your T levels are low, like something like that, some permutation of this. And so, all right, well, now we have a clinical question. Let's just go see if there's any answers in the literature. So I could not find any study predating 2007 investigating this. And in fact, this first study from Travison et al. In 2007, they even said that. They're like, look, there's no data on this. And so if anybody was saying this prior to 2007, I'm not personally aware of it. But also if they were, it's like, where are you getting this from? You just like felt it. I mean, Twitter was probably around then, but I don't know. Yeah, right. But yeah, many of these tweets like and Facebook posts and other social media stuff has gone viral. And so, yeah, again, it's just like assumed to be true. So let's look at some data on this. So this study from Travison et al. In 2007, they calculated testosterone levels obtained from individuals of similar ages at different times. And the time interval was 20 years apart. So effectively what they did is they looked at individuals who were between the ages of 45 and 65 in the 80s, 1983, something like that. And then 20 years later, they did the same thing, same age group, same community. And they're like, what's the secular trend of testosterone in these individuals? It was over 1,700 men living in and around Boston. The average age was 58 years old at both times of sampling. At time period one, the average total testosterone level was 501 nanograms per deciliter, and half of the samples were distributed between 392 to 614 nanograms per deciliter. 20 years later, the average total testosterone level was 391 nanograms per deciliter, and half of the samples, again, were distributed between 310 and 507 nanograms per deciliter. So it does look like it went down a little bit if you just look at those values straight on. But again, if you compare just the average values, 501 to 391, and you look at the analytical and biological variation, they're effectively the same. Now, granted, these aren't the same people, so you're not going to get that same biological variation.
And having higher numbers of samples will obviously tend to help increase your confidence of real changes between them. But of course, regardless, there's some element of variation that's going to be in the data. You just use bigger numbers of people to try to, wash out some of that systematic error, I suppose.
Yeah, but it's not 50%.
Right. Yeah.
It's not a 50% decline. Okay. And again, these sort of age, standardized testosterone values, that depends on who you're testing. Are these healthy individuals with no disease comorbidities, for example, or are they just this average person? And so what the researchers found is that there was a marked increase over time in chronic illness incidents. So things like obesity and overweight, type 2 diabetes, etc. There was a decrease in smoking, which can actually lower testosterone, but there was a marked increase, about 35% higher incidence of at least one chronic medical condition when they tested them 20 years later, or the new sample 20 years later. So already you're thinking, you're like, well, that kind of makes sense. If you have more chronic disease, more obesity, more overweight, yeah, that is a plausible explanation. And in fact, that's what's found in two other data sets. The only other two data sets I could find that evaluated this issue. So it was 100,000 plus sample size men in Israel, measured from the first time point was 2006. The follow-up time point was 2019. And they look at like the secular trend of total testosterone levels. Yeah, it went down a little bit, about a 10% drop. But again, way more chronic disease at this latter time period, because again, the diseases tend to, particularly with the westernized dietary patterns, insufficient physical activity, things of that nature, tend to be on the rise. Same thing happened in Danish men when comparing a time period 1980 to year 2000, over 5,000 samples, see the same relationship. In fact, in this Danish study that was published by Anderson in 2007, the authors concluded, adjustment for concurrent secular increase in body mass index reduced the observed cohort/period-related changes in testosterone, which were no longer significant. And it's like, yeah, dude, in general, people are gaining fat mass, and we know that to be like heavily involved in sort of testosterone physiology. And so I kind of would expect T levels to go down in a secular trend. I just don't think it's due to some like weird environmental sort of cause, or like the BPAs, the plastics, the estrogens, the whatever. It's more like people are gaining weight.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's probably multiple reasons why it could go down. But if you have a data set like this of like thousands of men and you observe a decrease that appears real, but as soon as you adjust for BMI, it disappears. Like the significance of that disappears, then it, is adequately explained. You're just measuring a rise in obesity via testosterone measurements, like in a different way. Now, if they adjusted for BMI and there was still some significant decline, then you're like, okay, well, what residual, effect do I need to explain by some other mechanism? Is it because of something else? Is it because of some exposure or whatever the case is? But it's like, once it disappears, it's like, well, I guess that was it then.
Yeah. And even if it didn't totally disappear, right? And because data, is messy and statistics can be manipulated all sorts of different ways. The thing here to take home is that it didn't go down by 50%. It didn't go, like, it's not half. All right. The 22-year-old and the 67-year-old, did not have the same testosterone levels. If it's gone down at all, and that's a real decrease, it's by a little bit. And to what clinical effect? I don't know. So the TLDR on this, normal testosterone levels vary, but are most commonly between 300 to 800 nanograms per deciliter. There's significant analytical and biological variation, which is very underappreciated when it comes to interpreting changes in blood tests and also just the values themselves. The secular decline in testosterone levels may be real or artifact, but if it's real, it's most likely due to increased overweight and obesity prevalence, alcohol use, chronic illness, and similar. And so that's kind of where we're starting from. Now, when we start to talk about male hypogonadism, which we'll move into our next section here on episode 228 with the different types of testosterone measurements. So Austin, I know you don't work in a primary care clinic. You're in the hospital, and measuring a testosterone level in the hospital, the lab would be like, why are you doing this?
I actually think there may have been a couple times when I checked it, but I also do some primary care telemedicine. And so I'm very open to measuring in that context. But yeah, you're right. For the most part.
Yeah. In general, no one's coming in from testosterone toxicity.
Yeah. It'd be like a very weird, like, you know, male with unexplained osteoporosis or something would probably be, yeah, you know, one situation where I might
fracture.
Think of that.
Yeah. So when measuring testosterone levels, three aspects should really be considered. What form of testosterone is being measured, what time during the day it's being obtained, and then how often should it be tested. And so there are multiple different forms. Let's start with that. So one is total testosterone. And Austin, if I'm guessing, if you have somebody who comes in with like an unexplained low bone mineral density and like a non-traumatic fracture, you're like, all right, we're going to send a total testosterone, a total T level. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So this is an antibody test that can measure values between 2 to 1500, depending on the exact test. Now, I've seen multiple tests that are outside the reference range. Yep. And usually these are not low. Yeah. In general, it's like, wow, this person has way more muscle mass than me. And they're above 1500. So that would be an example of somebody using exogenous testosterone levels at higher than normal doses, and they're above the reference range. I've also seen it on people who are on TRT, so testosterone replacement therapy, who like injected in the arm where the venipuncture was done directly before the test. And so it's like, look, man, you got all that T just floating around. Yeah, that might happen. So in any case, this is a monoclonal antibody test. It's effectively antibody is a protein that combined to testosterone, and it gives you a readout. Pretty accurate. Their second form of testosterone that can be measured, it's usually calculated, though, is called free testosterone. And it's calculated based on this Vermeulen formula, where you know the steroid hormone binding globulin, the SHBG, the albumin levels, and then the total testosterone levels is plugged in this equation, and you get calculated free testosterone. It's not really an accurate measure of actual circulating unbound or free testosterone, but it does seem to correlate a little bit more strongly with different androgenic actions like bone mineral density, sexual function, and various levels of like hematopoiesis, so red blood cells, hematocrit, hemoglobin, things of that nature. But in any case, you're not really measuring free testosterone directly. One interesting study, this is back to that EMAS, that European male aging study. It was 3,000 euro dudes. They didn't have any hypogonadism, like as far as signs and symptoms. And they were followed for 4 years. So no hypogonadism at baseline. They were followed for 4 years. And they were given these questionnaires 4 years later, on average, about sexual, physical, and psychological function. In general, those with normal calculated free testosterone lacked clinical characteristics of hypogonadism, whereas those with low calculated free testosterone were the only ones who had signs, despite having like a normal total testosterone. It just suggests that although the free testosterone value that you get by calculating it using this Vermeulen formula may not be a very accurate number, it may correlate better with the sort of androgenic function, particularly in individuals who have abnormal steroid hormone binding globulin levels. And those conditions that cause like abnormal steroid hormone binding globulin, SHBG levels, are numerous. Obesity, overweight, diabetes, hypo or hyperthyroidism, kidney disease, liver disease, HIV, the list goes on and on and on. And so having that additional value may be useful for somebody who goes into get tested and their first test may be abnormal. The second time around, you might want to get a calculated free testosterone just to sort of better characterize what's going on. But we'll get into that when we talk about testing and diagnosis. Austin, you want to talk about this equilibrium dialysis technique?
Yeah. So you had mentioned that free testosterone can be you know, determined through a calculation, assuming you've measured SHBG and albumin levels and testosterone levels. But the other method and is known as this equilibrium dialysis technique. What that exactly means or entails, I cannot speak to. However, I know from having gone through, you know, guidelines and some of the evidence on these tests is if you are going to obtain a free testosterone measurement, that is supposedly a preferred method to do so. Yeah. And I will say that I don't think that it is often necessary to obtain this for all patients when making, you know, routine decisions in practice. And the other thing I'll add just relating to, you know, these tests in general is I learned about this actually when I went to the American College of Physicians conference just a couple months ago in San Diego. There was a lecture by an expert in this field. And he described how the CDC in recent years has started basically a lab standardization program, testosterone standardization program, that if you just Google that CDC testosterone standardization, it'll be the first result. I'm sure we can provide a link. But basically, you know, because of the recognized issues with reliability of tests, they started this program to improve accuracy of measurements, to improve reliability of measurements, and to institute methods to monitor lab accuracy and reliability over time. And so, you know, on the diabetes podcast we did relatively recently, I think it was like the metabolic syndrome in athletes might have been that one, we talked about how there was a similar program instituted for hemoglobin A1C measurements to standardize them because there were such problems with different labs running them differently. And there are lots of labs that are like this where there needs to be some sort of standardization method so that you can reliably compare values obtained across different labs. And so because of how fraught testosterone testing has been, the CDC started this kind of a standardization program. And they have a listing of labs that are participating in this particular program. And so it was suggested when I attended this talk that if you're going to be, you know, ordering these tests for patients, if you're a healthcare professional, or, you know, perhaps if you're a motivated patient and you want to make sure that the measurements you're getting are reliable, that using a lab that is on this list or participating in this standardization program would be advisable.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that and I was like, ooh, interesting. Because effectively, if you're sending people to different labs that have different, like, you know, assays and different non-standardized techniques, you're either getting not only inaccurate data, but like difficult to compare, and you're just delaying treatment, you know, or delaying workup of an individual because you have to get them tested again at the same lab.
Yeah, so you might be just magnifying some of that analytical variation unnecessarily. So I would recommend using standardized methods like this.
Yeah. Also, just a reminder, bioavailable testosterone, again, is the combination of albumin-bound testosterone and free testosterone. So that's another thing you may see on a test. And again, this and the calculated free or directly measured free testosterone may or may not be better for monitoring. We just don't really know yet. And that's kind of reflected in these different guidelines. There are, when I counted, it was 9 different international guidelines that I had reviewed for this podcast. And I was like, couldn't y'all just get together and like come up with one thing? And they're like, nah, dog, we want our own. So here we are. Okay. So that's the form of testosterone that you can get measured. Second important thing, again, is the time of day. And so we're supposed to measure testosterone levels between 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. in a fasted state. And so you often hear that the production of testosterone is diurnal, and the production of LH, luteinizing hormone, and follicle stimulating hormone, FSH, is pulsatile. But diurnal is a fancy way of saying daily. So it just happens every day. And testosterone levels fluctuate throughout the day, reaching a maximum of around 8 a.m. and a minimum value around 8 p.m. So in general, we're measuring it 8 to 10 a.m. Getting a testosterone level at noon, I don't know what to make of that, and neither does anyone else either. But people are doing it.
Or 5 p.m. or something silly like that. Yeah. Don't do that.
The more curious thing, and I tried finding some data on this. It's like, what about people who work like nights, for example? Like, are they still supposed to measure at 8 to 10 a.m.? Like, does this pulsatile and diurnal variation like change the game? And I'm like, I feel like I'm not going to come up with an evidence-based answer. So I don't know.
Yeah. I would probably expect it if I had to guess to follow their sleep-wake cycle, you know, after they flip. The other thing to point out is that some of this variation, you know, higher in the morning, lower in the evening, tends to get a bit muted and somewhat go away with aging. Still, though, I would not use that to say, oh, yeah, it's fine. My older person who's getting this checked, I'm just going to do it at 4 p.m. because it's fine. I would still, basically, the idea is that if we check it at a time when we expect it to be at its highest, and the person's body is capable of generating a normal, you know, blood concentration of this, then we can be reasonably confident that the machinery is in working order.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the idea of checking it during that particular moment in time.
Yeah. So as far as frequency goes, that's the third thing to consider. Basically, if a single value taken with that 8 to 10 a.m. thing is normal, we can assume that testosterone production is normal. That doesn't mean that the person's symptoms and signs are like, you know, just send them home, they're good to go, but just probably need to go down a different sort of pathway for the workup. If the single first value is low or borderline low, it should be repeated once or twice. And again, it just depends on which guidelines you're looking at and what they recommend. It's just important to confirm that the person has low total testosterone concentrations, because 30% of men with an initially low testosterone concentration will have a normal one the second time. And so as far as the time interval there, the British Society for Sexual Medicine recommends a 4-week interval, which I don't know where they came up with that number.
Seems like a very large period.
There's no citation. Hey, there's no citation there. They're just like, we recommend 4 weeks. It's like, okay, interesting. The International Society for Sexual Medicine recommends a 1-week interval, and the Endocrine Society in the United States doesn't have a specific time interval. They're just like, just measure it again, bro. And we're like, okay. So,
yeah, the other couple things I would point out here is that, you know, if you're going to get it checked, it should be at that right time, preferably fasted if possible, but also not in the setting of like major other issues going on. Like if you're sick, like not the time to get it checked. You know, so many things can impact this. And so, you know, perhaps that might be part of maybe that British Society's recommendation is like, maybe if you're a little sick, then 4 weeks we can reliably say you're going to be over your cold or something like that. I don't know, just making it up. But so that's one thing. And then the other is that you mentioned, you know, not to say that, okay, like dismissing whatever the person's signs or symptoms were that prompted this test measurement, because step number one, they should have some sign or some symptom or some issue that is leading this to be measured. We do not recommend just widespread screening of people who feel fine, who have no symptoms. But additionally, I have never, ever for a person who is reporting some kind of symptom like this, measured a total testosterone alone in isolation. And that is getting to the point that I'm sure we'll touch on later, is that a lot of the symptoms can be explained by so many other conditions. And so it is never just the only thing that I'm checking. I often want to make
sure it's an isolated total testosterone level.
Not doing it. I'm making sure they're not anemic, making sure their thyroid function's okay. Maybe thinking about their adrenals in certain contexts, maybe thinking about a sleep study, maybe talking about, you know, their, you know, checking their liver function if I'm worried about alcohol use or all sorts of other things, HIV testing, Hep C testing. Like, not to say that everybody needs all of these tests, but it's, you know, it's almost always multiple based on the person and what they're reporting for which clinical conditions could fit this kind of presentation.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of like what the worst like set of isolated tests would be that would just make your head actually explode. And I'm thinking like total testosterone, vitamin D, reverse T3. Like something you're like, and then like a boron level. And you're like, I don't know what to do with any of this. Please correlate clinically. You're like a radiologist, you know?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So with all that background, now we get into what is male hypogonadism, and then how to diagnose it, treat it, monitor it, and then we'll wrap up. So, definition. Male hypogonadism is a clinical syndrome that results from the failure of the testes to produce physiological concentrations of testosterone and or a normal amount of sperm due to disease at one or more areas of the hypothalamic pituitary testicular axis. So abnormalities at the level of the testes, that we call that primary hypogonadism, whereas defects in the hypothalamus or the pituitary cause secondary or tertiary hypogonadism. There are multiple different guidelines available. Again, I reviewed at least 9 of them that I can recall. Some of them refer to male hypogonadism as testosterone deficiency syndrome, TDS, whereas other ones refer to this as male hypogonadism. The terms are interchangeable. I don't have a sense of like where the field is moving, you know, like just like in the obesity field, obesity medicine, is it like adiposity based chronic disease versus obesity? Like, I don't get a sense.
It seems, I'm not sure where things are headed either. It seems to me that hypogonadism is maybe a little bit of a broader diagnosis in that it can also incorporate the sperm issues, whereas testosterone deficiency would not necessarily incorporate, you know, insufficient sperm production. Although, I mean, the things are related, so it's who knows, but I don't really care.
That'll actually become important later on. So nevertheless, whether for male hypogonadism or testosterone deficiency syndrome, the basic diagnostic criteria across all guidelines are broadly similar. A combination of clinical symptoms with biochemical evidence of low testosterone plus an impact on physical health and well-being. And that's important. Not only the clinical symptoms, but it also has to have an effect. And so there's this condition called exercise hypogonadal male condition, where effectively these elite athletes have what would be biochemical evidence of low testosterone, but they have no overt clinical symptoms and it doesn't cause an impact on their physical health or well-being. As far as like why their testosterone levels are low, some of it's due to, well, they were doing a lot of sweating, so their plasma volume has expanded. We also see like a decline in production of testosterone, but they keep up with that by increasing the androgen receptor sensitivity. And so their function is grossly normal. And so you're like, is this hypogonadism or is it just a lab value? So got to have more than just a lab value. You need a lab value, you need clinical signs and symptoms, plus an impact on your physical health and well-being, which again would help you determine what additional testing and workup would be necessary for diagnosis. So there are three broad categories of symptoms that people may have with male hypogonadism or testosterone deficiency syndrome. There are specific symptoms, suggestive symptoms, and then non-specific symptoms. So specific symptoms include incomplete or delayed sexual development. So during like the adolescent years, pubertal years, and before, incomplete or delayed sexual development would be a sign of either like androgen receptor insensitivity, low testosterone, absent testosterone, things of that nature, loss of body hair, and or very small testes. There are suggestive symptoms like reduced sexual desire and libido, decreased spontaneous erections and or erectile dysfunction, fertility issues, so a low sperm count, for example, a low trauma or no trauma fracture, so bone break, which would also coincide with low bone mineral density. This is like a person, like a 40-year-old dude who like falls over from standing and then fractures a femur. And you're like, how though?
Yeah.
Unexplained anemia can also be a suggestive sign, but there are many, many, many other things that can cause anemia, not just low testosterone.
Yeah, I would say that's nonspecific, but unexplained in the sense of you've ruled out all the typical and common causes of anemia, like bleeding and colon cancer and things like that.
And then there are nonspecific signs like decreased energy, motivation, self-confidence, poor concentration or memory, depressed mood, an increase in body fat or difficulty losing body fat. But again, those are all nonspecific, just like there could be so, again, many other causes, but note, you basically need to figure out like, okay, if I'm going to test this person for low testosterone, if that's in my differential diagnosis, what else is in there?
Mm-hmm. Because there are almost always other things.
If there's not other things, I kind of question the clinical practice going on, unless again, you've really done your due diligence and you're like, I don't even know now. I'm just going to send a total testosterone because everything else has been negative and I've thoroughly worked this person up. I guess I could see that, but
I would say there are always other things on the list of possibilities. The only situation I can think of where there's not another possibility on the list is if you are a strength coach.
Yeah, right.
And you do not have the capacity to think of other possibilities other than low testosterone for
everything. That's it. Yeah. So those are the symptoms, and again, specific to non-specific and everything in between. As far as the biochemical evidence of low testosterone in male hypogonadism or testosterone deficiency syndrome, this sort of cutoff level varies widely by society. So the American Academy of Clinical Endocrinologists, their cutoff is 200 nanograms per deciliter, whereas the International Society of Sexual Medicine is 350 nanograms per deciliter. There's no agreed upon lower limit, like, oh, you're below this level? We got to work you up. So effectively, if somebody tells me like, yeah, I got a value of 260 nanograms per deciliter on a total testosterone test, my first question is, why'd you get your testosterone level checked? And they're like, well, my doctor said I should just send it. And I'm like, but why though? Because without signs or symptoms, I'm like, I have no idea like why we're doing this. And so what other things could be causing this? So there are a number of other like medical conditions that can, you know, result in low testosterone and that may be causing these signs and symptoms, but if there's no signs and symptoms, I'm like, I have no idea what to do with this. Then when was it measured? And like, if it is low or borderline low, when's the follow-up for the repeat test? Assuming that there are signs, symptoms, and a negative effect on your life. So many questions.
This is just a typical thing that I've talked about on some other podcast about, you know, people's overconfidence in interpreting their own blood tests as far as knowing what it means and like without actually knowing all the underlying physiology and feedback loops. And, you know, additionally, one thing that we haven't talked about in this podcast is the idea that testosterone has to bind a receptor. And these receptors are proteins that are coded by, you know, our genes, and there can be variation and in these receptors, leading to differences in receptor sensitivity. And so I haven't seen like great data on this, but it seems very, very plausible to me that people who have highly, highly sensitive testosterone receptors, they would probably walk around feeling great at a relatively low blood testosterone concentration because their receptors are really sensitive. It hooks up to that receptor and they're like, cool, I got all I need. And maybe they live at a lower level numerically, but because their receptors are binding it and it's doing its job, that they're okay. Whereas somebody who has less sensitive receptors, receptors that do not bind it as readily and let it do its thing, they might actually naturally, through that feedback process, gravitate towards a slightly higher level. And they would also feel fine. But when you're only looking at one side of this equation, because we don't have a way to measure people's receptor sensitivity, and this is, you know, somewhat speculative, then you know, we're only looking at half of the picture here and putting all of the interpretive kind of emphasis on just that blood measurement. So that's a big part of why it's not possible to interpret these numbers if somebody has no issues going on. Don't check it.
Yeah. So a few things. So one, that EHMC, exercise hypogonadal male condition, one of the proposed mechanisms by why these people don't have signs or symptoms of hypogonadism is because they're like more sensitive to their circulating testosterone. They talk about this a little bit in the book, The Testosterone and Unauthorized Biography. It's a pretty, I'm going to give it an okay rating. It's pretty in depth, and if you're not like super keyed up on testosterone and controversy surrounding it, it's like, yeah, we get it. This could have been a 30 page, you know, pamphlet. But I thought it was a good read. In any case, there is some talk or some discussion of trying to create like an anabolic or an androgenic sort of sensitive like score. So based on like you're measuring one thing and correlating it to a particular testosterone level to be like, oh, this person has this level of androgenicity or anabolic sort of sensitivity. And it's like, okay, well, we're just going to make up stuff and see what, like, if we can validate anything. But yeah, at present, there's no way to determine how sensitive people are to circulating androgens. Okay. So in saying all that, no agreed upon lower limit connected to clinical outcomes or biochemical evidence, and it varies based on the international organization. So somewhere though between like 200 and 350 is kind of that biochemical sort of evidence of male hypogonadism, provided somebody has signs, symptoms, and a negative impact on their life. As far as the prevalence, so how often does this happen? It's been estimated to be somewhere between 6 to 12%, depending on the study population and the degree of diagnostic rigor that's going on within those studies. In general, this is low quality evidence, because the majority of the epidemiological studies are based on sperm production issues. So just like in male infertility, low sperm count, et cetera. And they often have normal testosterone. So it's like, is this male hypogonadism or is it just, you know, infertility? And if so, like, mightn't that be due to something else other than low testosterone, particularly if they have normal testosterone levels? So I don't know if I can tell you how often this is occurring in a confident level. And I don't know that anybody else can either. As far as known causes, there are a ton of them. Some of them are congenital. So things like Klinefelter syndrome, which is actually like the most common congenital type of, you know, you're born with it. It's like 5 in every 10,000 live births, but maybe even higher, because sometimes they have, it's like on a, it can be like a lower level of Klinefelter syndrome, maybe more like 10 to 25 per 10,000. So just pretty common. And in fact, is like, if you worked somebody up thoroughly for hypogonadism, and it looks like their LH and FSH levels are also low, you might actually screen them, do a genetic test to be like, oh, you actually have Klinefelter syndrome. You can be born without testes. Down syndrome also is a known cause of hypogonadism, like 10 to 30 per 10,000 live births. Typically have normal T when they go through puberty, but then it declines later on and have low levels of spermatogenesis, and a bunch of other syndromes whose names I will forget. Noonan syndrome. You remember that?
No, I don't. Okay. But I don't do pediatrics.
There you go. Yeah. There are acquired disorders that either injure or can like infiltrate. So things like compromising the anatomy of the testes or the hypothalamus or the pituitary gland or all of these things. But things like, you might expect, testicular cancer, trauma or infection to the testes, which is called orchitis. Traumatic brain injury is like one of these it's not new because it's been happening since the beginning of, you know, the human species, but it's been increasingly recognized as one of the more common causes of like acquired male hypogonadism. Iron overload, hemochromatosis, prostate cancer therapy, pituitary adenoma. And so like the classic boards question was like, you know, young male presents with signs of what would be consistent with male hypogonadism and a visual deficit. You're like, and then the question is like, what's your next move? And you're like, okay, got to get a total testosterone. I got to get FSH, LH, and I got to get an MRI of the pituitary gland just to make sure they don't have a macroadenoma. And then different drugs. So certain anticonvulsants can cause elevations in prolactin levels. So hyperprolactinemia can cause itself, low testosterone, corticosteroids, which are not the cool kind of steroids. They're steroids that people take for autoimmune diseases and other conditions, chemotherapy, opioids, the list. I mean, we could do a whole section on just the pharmacology behind acquired hypogonadism, but there are a lot of things there. As far as risk factors for sort of acquired hypogonadism later in life, again, opioid use, like we just said, androgen use. So if somebody's taking anabolic steroids and then has been off of them for a period of time, it is likely that their testosterone level will be low until they recover. If they recover total testosterone levels, alcohol use, particularly alcohol abuse. We have a podcast on that. Sleep apnea, cancer of various types, diabetes, obesity, HIV infection, you know, sleep restriction. There's just
lots
of things. In any case, there's a lack of large systematic studies, though, really about like thoroughly evaluating risk factors and sort of like the risk potential. So, for example, sickle cell anemia is cited as a known cause of hypogonadism, but it's only reported in different case series. So a small collection of medical studies and the prevalence by which sickle cell disease causes hypogonadism is unknown, despite 300 to 400,000 births a year in sub-Saharan Africa with people that have sickle cell disease. You'd expect if it was this huge like cause that it might, you know, have a increased signal if these people were being tested for male hypogonadism. So maybe that's the problem. In any case, it's just not been thoroughly investigated enough with the rigor that you would expect, considering how confidently people feel about testosterone replacement therapy on the internet. In any case, a lot of different causes. But as far as the workup, Austin, I'm going to let you do your thing here because we're going to first just start this conversation with screening. Should the male population be screened for hypogonadism? Just everybody gets tested.
No. Next question.
Move on. Okay. Well, here's the thing though. Why shouldn't I get tested? Well, I just want to know.
Yeah. And honestly, that's not an argument that I really care to engage. If somebody wants to go spend their money and get a test, that's fine. They can do whatever they want. I'm not here to like restrict people from being able to do what they want with this kind of thing. I think that there are clear downsides to getting tests that are not clearly indicated from a standpoint of cost and inconvenience and time. And then the ultimately resulting with getting potentially getting test results that are unhelpful or can lead you down a wrong path. And so this is in particular, like let's say somebody even does have symptoms. And all they get is a testosterone measurement and it's low. And they're like, well, just put me on testosterone and it'll fix everything. It's like, well, nobody thought about this. Nobody took a history or maybe did an exam or anything like that to get a sense of, you know, maybe this person's symptoms, maybe they're just tired and they're tired because they have no immune system because they have HIV, but all they checked was testosterone. And the lowest testosterone measure I've ever seen was in a patient who I had in residency who had AIDS. That basically an undetectable testosterone measurement. It was like effectively zero. And the person felt okay, which was amazing to me. But that aside, it requires somebody to think about what is this person's issue and what could be, you know, consistent with it and doing that whole thing rather than just checking one thing and being potentially led astray, putting them on testosterone and missing the bigger problem. If you feel completely fine and you're like, I just want to get numbers, okay, like I don't think that there's any clinical utility to that. And additionally, you can be led astray not only if you get some kind of a false positive, false negative type result, but also accounting for all that variation, that analytic variation, that biological variation. You're just going to like freak yourself out unnecessarily if it dips by 50 points by thinking that that's real, or you're going to pat yourself on the back thinking that you're doing awesome if it goes up by 50 points. None of that even mattered. None of it is real. So I don't think it's worth the time and effort. I think there are way better things to do with your time and money and effort. And so that's in general, I think that widespread screening indiscriminate of signs or symptoms or anything else is not wise for the vast majority of things outside of like blood pressure and blood lipids.
Yeah. Maybe body weight. But again, that assumes that some,
that's a sign.
So as far as screening, these international organizations do not recommend that people get screened, everybody gets screened. Rather, they're doing, you know, dedicated testing based on somebody's presentation. So the Endocrine Society, for example, recommends evaluation of testosterone levels for men deemed to be at increased risk of having hypogonadism that are also likely to benefit from testosterone replacement therapy, such as those with low libido, erectile dysfunction, infertility, HIV-associated weight loss, osteoporosis, or low trauma fracture, history of anabolic steroid use, or opioids, or other drugs or substances that affect testosterone production or metabolism. There's additional recommendations depending on the different guidelines that you're looking at. For example, to evaluate total testosterone levels in those with obesity, with like a BMI greater than 30 or waist circumference greater than 102 centimeters or 40 inches. Those with type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome. Those are just basically conditions that are known to cause some lower testosterone levels. The treatment is actually super interesting here because they call that like a functional male hypogonadism. And effectively, the recommendation is instead of prescribing testosterone to start, is a trial of lifestyle medicine to see if you can correct the underlying sort of condition.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, it's interesting. This guideline, I would suspect if you talk to the vast majority of primary care folks, they are not routinely screening individuals with obesity or diabetes for
low testosterone. No, you got a BMI of 30, we're at a T level.
I do not see that happening in practice. And as you mentioned, I think that if somebody did check it on that basis, I would be unsurprised if it were low. And the correct management is still the same correct management as it would be for obesity and diabetes, focusing on, you know, addressing that issue as a way to thereby improve the testosterone measurement. I've seen countless times facilitating weight loss, getting better control of diabetes or other conditions like that, leading to substantial increases in testosterone levels in people. And so that would be my preferred initial strategy, is trying to facilitate weight loss through all the ways that we've talked about on prior podcasts, be it lifestyle, meds, surgery, et cetera, or treating the diabetes. However, I will also say that there is some evidence that among people in this situation with obesity and type 2 diabetes, that initiating them on testosterone replacement therapy can also lead to some improvements in those things. I would say that that is not standard practice, but just being, you know, real with the data that we have. Again, I don't think that is going to be routine practice for most folks, but yeah, that's kind of what it is.
Okay. So that's like the workup. As far as the diagnosis goes, many guidelines recommend diagnosing and considering offering TRT on the basis of just a serum testosterone level alone. But again, there's no agreed upon cutoff. And so I favor the Endocrine Society's sort of guidelines here, like where you would want not only the clinical signs and symptoms associated with male hypogonadism, but also the negative impact on the individual's life. And then they have this additional cutoff point of 264 nanograms per deciliter. So I just, again, making the diagnosis based on just a number, I think is short-sighted, and I would favor the Endocrine Society's guidelines based on some of the other ones that I've looked up. It should be noted that clinicians are not recommended to test men for testosterone deficiency who have or are recovering again from acute illness or engaged in short-term use of medications like opioids that suppress testosterone concentrations. You're going to get the weird value, and then you're like, I don't know what to do with this. And you're like, yeah, me either. As far as what should be tested first, again, it's a serum total testosterone. But again, it probably shouldn't be sent in isolation. Just like, yeah, we're just going to send this off. That's the only thing it could be. Should be, again, based on the clinical signs, symptoms, the medical history of the person. It's going to be a battery of tests based on those signs and symptoms. As far as if that first test comes back low or borderline low, then things get interesting. So the repeat measurement should also have, a total testosterone, but also should have either a free testosterone that's directly measured by the equilibrium dialysis, or a calculated free testosterone in conditions that have abnormal steroid hormone binding globulin. Again, those conditions are like obesity, diabetes, kidney disease, hypo or hyperthyroid, HIV, liver disease, etc. Once the diagnosis of hypogonadism is confirmed, then you go down another rabbit hole. Now you got to figure out why. Okay, so testosterone levels are low. What do we do now? So you want to measure LH and FSH, And then potentially like a thyroid panel, prolactin, iron panel, and consider a brain MRI if either prolactin levels come back high or if there's a pituitary problem or other signs associated with that. Primary hypogonadism, which again is this sort of decreased function of the testes themselves, will tend to have a high LH, luteinizing hormone, and FSH. Basically, that means your pituitary gland and your hypothalamus are doing their normal thing, but the testes are like, nah, dog, I'm good.
Yeah, this is primary testicular failure. And so when the testes fail, the lack of feedback by testosterone to those higher areas in the pituitary and the hypothalamus leads them to start screaming at the testes to make more testosterone, but they failed. So those levels are high. They must be high to diagnose this condition.
Yep. Whereas secondary hypogonadism will have normal or low LH and FSH, which basically means the pituitary gland and or the hypothalamus are not responding appropriately. And so now you're like, why though? So depending on the rest of the clinical picture, that will inform the rest
and
of the work.
And similarly, this is a place where people can get tripped up because not just low FSH and LH, but inappropriately normal FSH and LH, which is the classic med student stump question, because the lab value that will come back, it might be solidly within the normal range. And you'll be like, oh, sweet, my FSH and LH are normal. They are not supposed to be normal if your testosterone is actually low, because you should have normal feedback to fix it. So this can be another tricky thing to try to interpret. And another reason why people shouldn't just get their own labs and try to interpret them themselves.
Agreed. All right. So all of that, you've been diagnosed with male hypogonadism. You've been appropriately worked up. And now it's time to treat. So let's assume that there's nothing else medically going on that requires further management that is ultimately causing the hypogonadism. It's just isolated male hypogonadism. So what do? The goal here is to recover and or maintain secondary sex characteristics and correct the symptoms of testosterone deficiency. So whatever the person, the negative effects on their life and well-being. So as far as who gets treated, again, it's the people who have signs and symptoms of male hypogonadism, the biochemical evidence of low testosterone and the negative effect on their life. And again, the guidelines here range all over the place as far as the sort of the pet projects, the people who get treated or whatever, but they all basically affirm that testosterone placement is indicated with a verified diagnosis of hypogonadism. The presence of clinical symptoms combined with the unequivocal biochemical finding of low testosterone, provided there are no contraindications to treatment with testosterone. So things like prostate cancer, for example, or other conditions that are like, can't really treat you with testosterone. The most controversial thing here is people like borderline low testosterone levels. So it's super controversial. It just depends on which clinical practice guidelines your doctor happens to be up on, if they're up on any at all. And so they're just markedly different recommendations. This is probably most applicable not only to our listenership, but the population at large, because probably the biggest driver of reduced testosterone levels in the population is going to be chronic medical conditions, particularly obesity and overweight. And so some guidelines are saying, oh, you can do a trial of TRT plus lifestyle. Other guidelines are saying just do lifestyle and weight and then reassess. And so it just kind of depends. But yeah, that it's kind of all over the place. Austin, do you have a feeling on this?
This would be something I would decide on a case-by-case basis, but it's actually quite common with a variety of other endocrine hormone-related conditions. For example, in the spectrum of diabetes, patients with pre-diabetes, quote-unquote, whose glucose or A1C measurements fall in that range, a significant proportion of people who fall in that range, if you just chill and recheck later on, will regress back towards normal blood sugar handling. Similarly, with people who have mildly abnormal thyroid tests, what we call subclinical hypothyroidism. If you just chill and recheck it later on, a significant proportion will normalize on their own. And so those are people who you'd be able to spare treatment, who you would not necessarily be over-treating by initiating them on therapy right up front. And so I'm not surprised that in people with kind of borderline test results here, your options could include chilling, rechecking down the line, and a significant proportion of people will normalize on their own, which would be, if it were me, preferable compared to initiating a lifelong therapy. Other people, they might value things differently and choose a different route when working, with their healthcare professional.
Yep. Agreed. Okay. So as far as the different types of agents, it really depends where you live in the world. In the United States, a bunch of different options here. There are injectables. So different forms of testosterone, they tend to be less expensive. They do have flexible dosing. The bigger problem here is there's more peaks and valleys the way it's administered, and also an increased risk of erythrocytosis, which is a fancy way of saying like your hematocrit and hemoglobin go way up, which is a contraindication to treatment with testosterone. There's also transdermal gels. Also have flexible dosing, don't have to inject yourself, low risk of erythrocytosis or red blood cell line expansion. Problem here is the potential transfer to somebody else who doesn't want to be on testosterone, and it also tends to be more expensive. There are other types of delivery systems, pellets, patches, nasal gels, etc. I assume this will continue to expand outside of the US. There's all sorts of other stuff that you can do as well, but those are like the main ones. We're obviously not prescribing people TRT here over the internet, but like, do you have a preferred route of administration, or do you say, what do you like to do? And he goes, I like needles. And you set
yeah. Yeah. My preferred would be one of the injectables. That's mm-hmm. usually what I use most often. Yeah.
Okay. And so after picking an agent, the next topic here is monitoring. So like what do you just set them home and don't do anything else? So you're monitoring things like the testosterone levels, their hematocrit levels. What's the first time that you have them come back for a lab draw? Like how soon?
Since I do not work in an outpatient clinic, this is not something that I'm routinely doing. But sure. If I feel confident in my diagnosis and initial treatment plan, then at some point, probably within the first 3 months, I would probably want to check in and see how things are going.
Yeah, that's the guidelines. They're like within that 3 to 6 months of like initiating treatment, get a testosterone level, a hematocrit level. And then if that looks good, you can do it every year after that. Ideally, you're doing it at the trough level. So if it's an injectable, it's like right before you're going to do another injection, just to make sure that, okay, we're, you know, keeping you in the normal range the entire time. And so, yeah, it should be right before you inject again. And you're looking for the sort of middle level, average level of testosterone. You don't want them to be high, like towards the upper end. Just think about this. If somebody came in and they're just about to inject again and their testosterone level's 800, you're like, so that means for the entire week beforehand, your levels were likely super physiological. And now are you getting back into range. Similarly, if somebody came in right before they were going to inject and they were like at 150, you're like, maybe it's not therapeutic enough. And so that's kind of the idea here. Additional things that you can measure, you can measure PSA, prostate specific antigens. There is some risk of prostate cancer. And so if you're doing that, you're looking for a bump. Like if that goes up significantly, you're like, I don't know that I like this.
Yeah, I think that's something that you'll also find some controversy around. I personally do not tend to follow those because I'm not convinced that this is going to cause that. I think that, the other question, not necessarily cancer, but could it contribute to some, you know, increase in the size of the prostate and some urinary symptoms and things like that. But a PSA level is not going to help you, you know, determine that or measure that. It's going to be what the person tells you is going on. So this is going to be also a case by case thing. Some patients are, you know, for whatever reason, very high risk for prostate cancer, and maybe they're going to want to monitor things to be extra, extra safe or whatever the case is. But as a default, I don't think that this is absolutely necessary for all people. Some labs might actually monitor estradiol levels, which is a form of estrogen. And so since excess testosterone can get converted into estradiol, they'll measure this and see if estradiol levels are too high. Some clinicians will just put you on a medicine that'll then suppress the conversion of testosterone to estrogen. I do not do that. I would suggest that if you're on TRT and your estradiol levels, if they're being checked, are too high, it's probably just a sign that the test dosage is too high and that needs to probably come down.
Yep. Okay. So now we'll get into risks versus benefits of TRT and then we'll wrap this up. So risks here tend to be around this either erythrocytosis, which is again just expansion, more you're forming way too many red blood cells, cardiovascular disease, and subclinical prostate cancer, not to mention infertility. So with respect to heart disease, the current guidelines state that there are no credible evidence that testosterone increases the risk of cardiovascular events, provided it is prescribed appropriately to men with a well-founded diagnosis of hypogonadism. And just to repeat, in people that have correctly diagnosed hypogonadism, we do not think that there's a reliable signal that TRT, again, at the dosing that is appropriate for TRT, increases risk of cardiovascular events. So things like heart attack, stroke, et cetera. But if you administer it inappropriately, then things go off the rails. So two landmark clinical trials raise safety concerns about cardiovascular events when testosterone was prescribed to older men having a primary diagnosis of age-related frailty or having quote-unquote functional hypogonadism associated with obesity, type 2 diabetes, or metabolic syndrome. These are people who did not meet clinical criteria for male hypogonadism, yet we're given testosterone. And this is a question we get all the time. It seems like it's like every other seminar or maybe every seminar and you just call them. It's like, yeah, well, what about like an older person who's like not, you know, in good shape? Like, mightn't it actually benefit their health if we put them on a little TRT? And it's like, ugh, I don't know that I can confidently say that, but I do think the risk of cardiovascular disease goes up. There's also this risk of QT interval shortening, which happens with testosterone administration, but no studies actually evaluated the effect of that. So potentially an issue there with getting a short QT arrhythmia. Infertility is another thing. So again, as I referenced earlier, some of the male contraceptives that are being tested right now are based on testosterone. But you know, if an individual was taking TRT, they are effectively have a very low chance of being fertile. And with anabolic steroid like abuse, there's a prolonged sort of infertility. It looks like with the male hormone contraceptions, after they stop taking them, it takes about 12 to 16 months to become fertile again. And this is like the proposed sort of time interval it takes for people like using anabolic steroids, but that really hasn't been evaluated.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think my take overall on the safety piece is for people who are, you know, accurately diagnosed and reasonably dosed with replacement, if that is the route they choose, it is actually quite safe
and beneficial.
And I do not have great safety concerns around the use of it when it's used appropriately. I do have more concerns when people are not appropriately evaluated in the first place or if the dosing is just nonsensical.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, there, as far as the benefits, I think the take home that I want to give people is that if in people who have signs and symptoms of hypogonadism, who are appropriately worked up and then appropriately managed and monitored, net benefit for treatment in general. But I also wouldn't ascribe any like, you know, crazy claims like TRT is a panacea. It's a game changer. So for example, people are like, oh, if and when you get older, you need to take TRT, it's a nootropic. You're going to have cognitive benefits. But when you actually evaluate the data on this, there's really no change in cognitive function compared to placebo. There's a really interesting study where it was a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial to investigate whether testosterone administration for 3 years would improve cognitive function in men aged 60 years or older with low to low normal serum testosterone levels with no identified disease of the testicles or the hypothalamus or pituitary gland. No difference between the placebo group and the folks getting TRT. It's just like, again, if you have people who have signs and symptoms and are appropriately diagnosed and they're appropriately treated, benefit. Good. Thumbs up. But like, let's not pretend that this is like a miracle drug. Okay, let's wrap this up. Take home here. Testosterone levels vary widely for men, but the most common like normal levels are between 300 to 800 nanograms per deciliter. There's significant biological and analytical variance when you test it. So it can be comparing two different numbers. You got to take that into consideration. The secular trend may be going down for total testosterone, but this is likely due to chronic disease like overweight, obesity, type 2 diabetes, et cetera, not some sort of like environmental cause or like, as some people would say, the pussification of the population. Probably not happening. Appropriate testing is beneficial for those with specific signs and symptoms associated with male hypogonadism, but general screening is not advised. After appropriate testing and workup, there are many treatment options, but again, testosterone is not like this panacea that treats everything. The risk-benefit profile depends on who's being treated and for what, but in general, if you have hypogonadism without any other contraindications and there's no underlying cause that is correctable, then treatment's probably beneficial, but you should suss that out with your doctor and not the guy that works at the Gold's Gym that you're frequenting.
Yeah.
Any other pearls you want to leave the listeners with?
I think I hammered the things that I care about the most.
I agree. All right. Well, that's a wrap on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. This is episode 228 TRT. Make sure you check out the links to the different studies that we reviewed here in the description below. Also, if you want to join us at a live event, links to that as well. New merchandise on the website, new article on the website, and check out our sponsors as well. But before you go anywhere, wherever you're listening to this, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll see you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.